All right, real quick, people, before we get into today's show, we've just released a new course, Periodization for Periods, all around how to train women around their monthly cycle, and we've got it on special. If you're interested, click the link in the show notes.
You are now listening to the Fitness Education Online Podcast, the podcast where fitness professionals go to grow their fitness business. If you're in the fitness industry, you'll find tips and strategies from proven business experts. Now, let's start the show.
G'day guys, welcome to the Fitness Education Online Podcast. This is a very special episode. We are starting our series called Bro Science, Sorting Fact from Fiction in the Fitness Industry. So we've got a special guest with us here today. Does work because he is my brother. He's also a doctor, a sports medicine-based doctor as well. It is Dr. Craig Matern, also known as the Sporting Doc. So we're going to be working through a whole heap of different things throughout these sort of series of podcasts. And the first one today, obviously, also, we want to get your questions and answer your specific questions. So if you're not in our Facebook group, jump into our Facebook group, the Fitness Education Online Community. Jump in there. If you do a hashtag, the Sporting Doc, ask your questions. We can add them to the list and we can do episodes of them on the future. First things first, Craig, welcome.
Hey, Travis, thank you for having me. Very exciting.
Very good.
We've been talking about doing this for a little while, so I'm very excited that I took a little bit of annual leave and we've found some time to do it.
Love it. So first things before we get into what we're going to cover today, let's let people, some of them may be new to you, some people may be familiar, or you may be familiar to them. Can you give everyone just a quick, you know, little rundown on yourself, your qualifications and sort of where you might fit within, you know, the fitness industry or fit within the health space, so to speak?
Yeah, no worries. So as per the introduction, I'm your younger brother, 4 years your junior, despite everyone telling me that I look significantly older, which is a bit unfortunate. 6'3", 93 kilos, can deadlift more than you, but cannot squat as much.
Or bench.
Or bench, that is also true. But or combined coin. Combined titles for the three power lifts, I think I've got you. Anyway, let's we'll talk about it afterwards. This is, save your questions till the end. So my background is I'm a GP. At the heart of it, I'm a GP, and I've had a bit of an interesting path in medicine that's been a bit atypical, and that's really led me to where we are today and really into a niche area of focusing on working in the stuff that I'm quite passionate about. So I went straight into medicine out of school. I was the very first year of medicine through Western Sydney Uni. It was UWS at the time. Went off and did my hospital time in St. George and Sutherland Hospital. And then I actually had signed up during uni to join the Army. And so in 2014, I headed off to Brisbane, started working with the Army, and have been an Army doc ever since. Back in Sydney since 2017. Got my GP training finished off when I was in Brisbane. And then came back and managed to finish off a postgraduate diploma in sports and exercise medicine. I did that through the University of Otago as a mostly by distance through that university based in Dunedin in New Zealand. I managed to finish that qualification with distinction last year. And then through my Army time, I've done a few other sort of occupational things. So I'm actually accredited to do medicals for pilots. So I do aviation medicine stuff. For both military and civilians through CASA, so through the Australian Civil Aviation Safety Association Agency, and have also recently done the same for commercial diving. So I can do commercial dive medicals for people who are professional scuba divers in their industries. So where that leads me now is my real passion is, you know, really passionate about sport. So we grew up with a household of four boys. We played sport. Probably before I could walk, we were playing sport in some kind of competitive measure. You might be able to provide more details on that than I can. I could barely remember last year at this point because well, you're probably the same. We've both got young kids, so the memory is somewhat patchy. I don't know about you.
It's pretty blurred by the whole COVID situation as well.
That too. So I've just started to build up my own business. So I am still full-time in the Army. currently working in a clinic that that exclusively looks after special forces members. So a lot of the stuff that I'm interested in doing is around sort of human performance and high performance. And I've just set up my business, which is High Performance Medical. So if you follow me on Instagram, the.sportingdoctor, it's mainly stuff around that business model, and that's moving into that high performance space. So a lot of it will be a mix of occupational medicine, so doing medicals for pilots and commercial divers, but the other real space I'm really interested in is sports medicine, with a real focus on preventative care. So not so much just seeing people with busted up knees and ankles and shoulders and sore backs, is seeing people and preventing those things from becoming a problem, being a real advocate for using exercise as a prescription to improve people's health, and helping people to identify the fact that I think personal trainers can probably have a bigger difference than GPs in terms of people's quality of life and longevity of living healthy lives, because it's just so important that we get people out and moving.
Perfect. So few things, lots of stuff there. But the one thing I just want to ask is the sports medicine degree or the postgrad that you did. What is different in that than what a normal GP? So let's say I go to see my normal GP, who's also a Craig. So I go and see a Dr. Craig, I'll leave his last name out, and I see him, or I see you, Dr. Craig, and you've done your sports medicine thing. What's the sort of difference in that sort of training between the two of you?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So it's personally, I think it's a real travesty. We real travesty.
Well, lots of names.
That's a pun. That's a pun. I didn't even mean to drop it in. In my undergraduate degree, we had 5 weeks of musculoskeletal medicine. We learned about ACLs. We learned about vertebral disc bulges. It was pretty, 5 weeks out of 5 years was essentially how much we spent on musculoskeletal medicine. And then through my GP training, similar, not a lot of education around musculoskeletal medicine, short of some of the big ticket items, fracture management, managing some, injuries and sprains. But, unless you've got a special interest in it, a lot of GPs won't actually spend a lot of time dealing with musculoskeletal medicine, and they'll often just rely on their physiotherapist counterparts to look after a lot of these things, which is appropriate as long as they are able to identify what imaging they need and then direct them to the management they need. That's probably appropriate. I guess my difference is I'm more interested in being pretty actively involved. So my training took me 4 years to complete my postgraduate diploma. It's sort of a postgraduate level of study, so higher than sort of undergraduate or, the initial medical degree. It was a mix of physios, doctors, and a few allied health were doing the course, but essentially it was physios and doctors doing it. So it's an advanced degree for physios as well. And it's just, the subjects that I did were, a full term, a full semester on upper limb issues, a full semester on lower limb issues, a full semester on the importance of exercise prescription, which is kind of what we're talking about today, a full semester on nutrition, and then there was another semester on something else, just an introduction to sports medicine. So, yeah, it was sort of 5 semesters that I did over 4 years, because I got distracted by having kids and moving into state and other life things, but it was a decent chunk of work and definitely a big arsenal of stuff that I was, without being disrespectful, completely neglected in my undergraduate and my GP training, to be perfectly frank.
Yeah, so I suppose this is, it's not where we were going to go today to start with, but this is where I wouldn't mind jumping into, because these are the questions that, float around and get mentioned, and people who watch me might see me throw you under the bus here and there, or throw GPs under the bus here or there. And you probably hear plenty of fitness professionals throw GPs under the bus here and there. So, and look, I would say I do it as a bit of a laugh half the time, but it is an element of there's bad PTs, there's bad physios, there's bad GPs, there's good GPs, there's good PTs, there's good physios. There's a good and bad in all of them. So, With that in mind, just generally speaking, when we talk about GPs and we talk about, like, you've done this extra training, what's the sort of maybe it's hard to generalize, but what's the prescription for some of these things coming from a GP? So let's say, hey, let's give tablets, let's give pills, let's give this. How often are they prescribing better sleep or more exercise or those sort of things?
Look, it's it really varies. So I guess I can flip the question around. Like, in terms of your own health, think of any health problem you've ever experienced, any health problem your children have experienced, any health problem your wife has experienced. Unfortunately, GPs are expected to have an answer to all of those problems. So it is such a wide breadth of content that it is not, it's unspeakable or, not even humanly possible to be an expert on all of it. So that's the first thing. You know, GPs are doing a really difficult job. Yep. And a lot of people don't realise the way that the general practice in Australia is structured is that you're all, subcontractors essentially to yourself. Most GPs are working for themselves. If there's not patients coming through the door, unfortunately, they're not getting paid. So what that means is the way that the things are structured, there's not a greatest incentive to sit there and take time with people. And that's why you see a lot of these clinics, like the medical centres, where they sort of are pumping through lots of patients. And unfortunately, it's because if I was a regular civilian GP and I was sick, I don't get paid. If I take annual leave, I don't get paid. I have to contribute my own super. Like, you're doing it all as a complete contractor, despite the fact that you're almost a government employee, because all your pay, especially if you're bulk billing, all your pay comes from Medicare, but you're not getting long service leave for being a government employee. You're not getting any sick leave or super or annual leave. So, I don't begrudge the fact that GPs do need to earn a living for what is a very hard job and dealing with a lot of difficulties. But most GPs will openly say that they're not really interested in musculoskeletal medicine. It's not their forte. So there's a lot of other stuff that they focus on. And, the mainstay of general practice is chronic disease management. So a lot of family medicine. And I guess one thing just to sort of make a bit relatable is they say that you sort of attract patients that are in a similar life cycle as yourself.
Yep.
So for me, if I was working full-time in general practice, I imagine I'd be seeing a lot of young families, young professionals, seeing lots of kids and all that sort of stuff. And you find the older GPs start to manage some of the older patients and get a bit of a mix of that. The type of work that a male GP versus a female GP gets is obviously very different as well. It is definitely a special interest in terms of musculoskeletal medicine, sports medicine. And I would, as a bit of general advice, recommend people go through a physio to start with. Good physios, bad physios. But at least most physios are employees, so they'll give you their half an hour of time to sort out what they need to sort out. Coming back to the overarching question, how many GPs are prescribing preventative sort of positive health effects? A big part of it is telling people to, eat well, sleep well, exercise well, but it doesn't get much deeper than that. It doesn't really go into what, I wouldn't imagine I know any other doctors that prescribe exercises, which is one of the things that I do with most of my patients, is I'll prescribe particular physical exercises, so the same as you'd get from the physio. In terms of, sleep and fluid and those other sort of positive things, they're mentioned, but they're not something that they're not big ticket items. It's probably something that you get a bit more from the allied health side of things. So that's really something where the fitness industry can really lean in. So actually chatting to people about their dietary habits, about their sleep habits, about their hydration habits.
Yeah.
One of the big things of my sports medicine training was the importance of taking your physical activity history, because the one thing that we don't do as GPs, we get incentives for how much information we gather from our patients. So what medications are you on? What are your allergies? Are you a smoker? Family history, alcohol use, and that's usually where it stops. There's not many people saying, how much exercise do you get every day? What sort of exercise? How much sitting time do you do every day? All that sort of stuff, which is, looking at the evidence, probably more important in terms of keeping people healthier and living longer and costing less money in terms of ongoing healthcare.
Yeah, I mean, I think that probably is a really good segue into what we're going to talk about today, actually. So I was, my mouse is not working, so I can't bring up the actual quote. Bear with me. I'm all frozen. All right, so
midwinter days in lockdown, they're freezing us all.
Exactly.
Technology is not immune.
Exactly. So what you mentioned there really leads into something that has sort of, you know, we've posted on socials a couple of times, and the sort of conversations that have come around, you know, on Instagram and Facebook have been really interesting around this topic. And what you mentioned really leads into this topic. So the post that we've shared a couple of times is essentially this. A person smokes, has high blood pressure, diabetes, and is physically inactive. The thing that will improve their life expectancy the most is improving or being more physically active. So this is the quote that we sort of throw out there, and then we can go fact or fiction. We're trying to get responses from everyone, right? We're trying to create discussion. But this is the quote that we share, and it always generates a lot of an intense discussion. Bit of a mix, but I would say typically people say fiction. People typically lend to saying, well, you know, smoking's the big thing, or blood pressure, or diabetes. Is the diabetes managed? Is it this? Is it that? So there's obviously lots of wrinkles to this, obviously. But what we want to focus on is the overall question on how important is physical activity, and is that going to make the biggest difference? Bearing in mind, obviously, there's little layers, and, you know, like when you share this stuff on social media, there's not a lot of leg room to have, oh, well, provided their diabetes is managed, oh, well, provided they're this, or, oh, you know, like, so that's one of the discussions we want to get into today. So looking at this quote, looking at this information, can you tell us how important is physical activity compared to those things?
Let's take a quick break.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we're the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
Physical activity, particular respect to reducing physical inactivity. So that's one thing that starts to get really important when you look at the evidence, is it's not only about the 30 minutes a day recommended exercise, it's how much time people are sitting. So that's one thing that we'll talk about. So inactivity in itself is a problem, irrespective of how much exercise you're doing. But to answer the question, so that the quote is it's very similar to a quote that essentially I made to Jono on a little Instagram live a few weeks back. So the actual quote that sort of kicked this off for me was in my very first subject that I did for my sports medicine diploma. This sort of blew my mind. And so the terminology that they talked about was something called smoker diabesity, which is combining a smoker, a diabetic, and obesity. So that's that sort of cluster of three things. So not actually the blood pressure. The blood pressure is another thing that we can talk about. But in terms of the quote that we're looking at was physical activity on one hand and then smoker diabesity on the other hand. So a smoker, a diabetic, and an obese person.
All simultaneously?
Yes, all combined. And that's as a combined thing, as well as physical inactivity as the fourth risk factor. And it was, if you could change one of them, which one's going to make the biggest difference? And the answer will surprise the vast majority of people, and even especially the fitness professionals that have been commenting on your socials, because I have not seen anyone say that they believe that this was a fact. Now, and I'll be able to back this up with the evidence based on some studies that have backed this up. So not only does low physical activity, and what we're actually talking about in this example is low cardiorespiratory fitness. So physical activity leads to fitness. So it's a little bit of a chicken and egg. So we're sort of coupling those, physical inactivity and low cardiorespiratory fitness. That's probably a fair assumption. That's why we exercise, right? So
not to look good naked?
Well, it really depends. Your motivations may vary. So I exercise in order to improve my cardiorespiratory fitness so I can keep up with my kids. The reason you exercise is really up to you. Now, as long as you're exercising, it doesn't really matter what the motivation is, you know. Now, so that quote. So in terms of obese, smoker, diabetic, physical inactivity, getting that inactive person moving and getting that inactive person to improve their cardiorespiratory fitness will have a better outcome, a better impact on their longevity and their health than treating those other three things combined. Combined. So putting them all together. So obesity, smoking, and diabetes, you fix those three things, you don't make as big an impact as if you get the inactive, unfit person moving and fit. And that blew my mind. So that was told to me on day one of my residential weekend when I was in Dunedin in July 2016. They told me that and I was like, what the hell? That can't make sense. Like, I've just finished my GP training 6 months ago and I got told that I need to get people to stop smoking, I need to treat the diabetes, and I need to get them to lose weight. And not once did they say that I need to get people moving and exercising as a primary risk factor change.
Which, like, is interesting, because that's literally what was my question before we started this, right? Was how often are they prescribing these things? And, you know, like, it wasn't even, you know, you didn't even know it was a, you know, you essentially didn't even know, like, prescribing exercise essentially was a thing, right? Like, or maybe you knew it was a thing, but you didn't realize how important it was.
No, I thought prescribing exercise was important to treat the diabetes and treat the obesity. That's why I didn't think of it as an independent risk factor, because we're not taught about it. And it, so it blows my mind. So I don't know if we, so there's a table that we can share that, because a lot of people will probably have smoke coming out their ears going, no, smoking is horrible. Diabetes is horrible. Obesity is horrible. But I've got a table from a scientific study that tells you those things. And I can just go through it quickly just to paint a bit of a picture in people's minds. So essentially the study that this comes from looked at the attributable percentage, the attributable fractions that contributed to deaths in, it was 40,000 people. So there was over 3,000, there was almost 4,000 deaths out of 40,000 people. And they looked at the percentage of these health issues contributed. So the one on your quote that's a little misleading is high blood pressure is super bad for you. So high blood pressure and physical inactivity or lack of cardiorespiratory fitness are almost equivalent. Physical activity still tops it with a average of 16.5% contribution to deaths. That's averaging across men and women. Hypertension was at 15% in men and 7 or 8% in women. So let's put that at about 12% overall. So still significantly less than physical inactivity. And then if we go through the other ones, obesity, you're looking at about 2.5%. Smoking, you're looking at about 8 to 9%. High cholesterol, you're looking at about 2%, and diabetes, you're looking at about 2 to 3%. So in terms of the smoker diabetes, we've got 2.5 for obesity. We've got, let's say, 10 for smoking, so 12.5, and then let's say 3 for diabetes, we're at 15.5. That doesn't quite get to the 16.5% that we talk about for physical inactivity. So that's the raw numbers. That's what I'm saying when I'm making that statement, that the cumulative effect of getting someone fit and moving is better than treating those three things. That is based on the percentage attributable cause of death. And that's what really should open people's minds to realize that the most effective medicine we have is not a diabetes medication. It's not a nicotine patch, you know. It's not liposuction or stomach stapling or diet. It is getting people moving. Like, it is just so important. It is just absolutely mind-bendingly more important than other things. And the problem is it's so hard, because if you come and see me and I've got 15 minutes with you, how do I convince you that if you're sitting for 15 to 16 hours of the day, you are shortening your life compared to, oh, you're smoking, here's a patch that will help with that. Oh, you've got this issue with diabetes, here's a tablet that will help with that. Oh, you've got this issue with, you know, obesity, go and see a personal trainer. Like, not realizing that the one thing we need to do is motivate these people to get moving. Unfortunately, the way that the GP system is set up is You know, there's no way, it's really difficult to make that, you know, a financially worthwhile thing, because you're going to take a long time to try and get people exercising. You know, how long you come to a doctor's office, how long do you have to sit there for that person to convince you to change your lifestyle? Like, is that what the patient's there for? Probably not. You know, does the doctor have the ability to do that? Is there incentives to do that? Probably not.
So with all that in mind, let's go to the standards. So you're talking about getting people active being the biggest change for their life expectancy. What are we talking there? Are we talking, you know, you spoke about sitting, stuff like that. Are we talking the standard recommendations of half an hour of moderate to high intense exercise a day? What are we talking?
Yeah, so I mean the physical prescription. So I guess there's two things. So it's limiting sedentary time, so limiting inactivity, and then meeting your physical activity goals. So they're separate things. So let's just focus on the physical activity side of things. The recommendation is that everyone should be doing 30 minutes at least five times a day. Ideally, 60
minutes.
Five times
a day, five times a week.
Well, five times a day would be great. Sorry, five times a week. Correction. Yes. So at least five times a week. Ideally, 30 minutes every day. And that's of moderate to high intensity. If you're doing low intensity, you should be doing 60 minutes a day. If you're doing ultra high intensity, you can shorten your time window. So you can kind of adjust the dose, but you should be trying to achieve, you know, 3.5 hours of moderate to high intense exercise every week.
What off the top of your head, you may or may not have this, moderate, is that increasing your heart rate by a certain percentage? What are we talking?
So moderate is probably going for a jog and being able to sing while you're jogging. So if you can sing while you're jogging, that's moderate intensity.
It's pretty hard for me.
Well, that's because you've got despite the size of your nose, it's not very effective, but most people can breathe through their nose a little bit. But the whole idea is you've got to be able to Beyonce it up and run and sing at the same time or carry out a conversation. So if you can jog, so if you're walking, that's low intensity, yeah? If you're normally walking, if you're sort of power walking and you're huffing and puffing, that's probably getting to moderate. If you're going for a jog and you can carry out a conversation, that's moderate. If you're pushing yourself harder that you couldn't possibly speak to someone, you're probably looking at getting into the moderate to high intensity as a rough gauge.
Perfect. So we're establishing here that getting rid of inactivity is a highly vital role, right? Of high importance.
Yes.
We've spoken about the fact that GPs are maybe not aware of how important this is.
Yeah.
One thing we've spoken about is allied health, and this is something that I'll add in from the fitness side of things, is there's a big push at the moment to try and get fitness professionals to sit in the allied health space, because currently fitness, where it sits, is in sport and recreation. So it sort of sits in this sort of weird spot of like outdoor activity and rock climbing and this and that, like, which is okay. But fitness is a thing. They're trying to push it more into this space of allied health. Recently, Fitness Australia has partnered with, I believe it is Bupa. So now you can claim PT sessions and stuff as part of health insurance. So as a PT, you get like a provider number if you register with Fitness Australia. How important do you think, or how much of a difference do you think it could make societally with fitness or becoming part of that allied health space? Like, as a GP, would you, yeah, do you think that'd be something that'd be embraced by GPs? Do you think it'd be something that'd be going like, no, these guys are, you know, cert 3, cert 4, I've done my 5-year degree, blah, blah, blah. I've done my internship, I've done my extra study on to become a GP. Do you think it'd be something that would be embraced by the medical profession, or where do you think it sits?
Well, you probably have to take a pay cut if you join the health industry, I suspect. We're not well known for well remunerating our members, unfortunately, in health. It's not where we do a lot of funding. But no, look, I think it's a tricky one, because it starts to get into a little bit of that sort of scope of practice, grey, black area. As I've been talking about, I 100% would embrace fitness being part of the health industry, because exercise is medicine. So I have no issue with it whatsoever. I guess the question is just finding that balance, because we've all had experience of the loose cannon effect of, of once you sort of give people a little bit of a leeway, they might sort of overstep their training time. But you know, as long as the industry is already relatively well regulated, you've got all your public liability insurance to make sure you're not busting people up. You've got all your professional registrations, which sort of helps to make sure that everyone is doing the right thing. So realistically, one of the best things about the health field is it's highly regulated. You know, we're all sort of accredited health practitioners in Australia, are members of the Australian Health Practitioners Registration Authority, and that ensures that everybody meets a standard. They maintain their ongoing education. They know the left and right of what they should and shouldn't be doing. So I would wholeheartedly support it. What the mass majority, as I said, I think there probably need to be some education, because I suspect, as I said, a lot of GPs don't really understand the importance of exercise. But, you know, we've got exercise physiologists, so we often will prescribe exercise physiologists. But one of the things that we do, and that is a good feature of Medicare when it's used appropriately, is we've got sort of team care arrangements and chronic care plans where you can involve multiple people. And so including a PT in that would be awesome, because at the moment we can refer to a podiatrist and a physio and an exercise physiologist, and they can get a Medicare rebate towards those services, as well as, you know, a psychologist or a endocrinologist to manage their diabetes or X, Y, and Z. So including eligibility on enhanced primary care items with a fitness professional would be great. Whether that's an extra thing from, you know, cert 3 and cert 4, whether you have to jump through an extra hoop, that may be appropriate. I don't know. You're the fitness expert. You tell me. Maybe they all need to be appropriately trained by Fitness Education Online to be prepared for that next step up to that higher level of delivery.
Something like that. But I think... You know, you talk about the health industry being regulated, and that's sort of the big discussion inside the fitness field at the moment, having gone through COVID or going through COVID, where gyms are just getting shut down without question. Outdoor training's just been shut down without question. You know, Fitness Australia is the largest sort of body we've got, and they've been working hard to try and change the perceptions and stuff within the government.
What's the health impact of all these people sitting on their ass so much more?
Exactly. So
they've monumental.
Been working, yeah. So they've been working hard on some of those things. But it's hard, you know, like compared to say the construction industry got shut down for a week, and
I think it might have been 2 weeks, but yes.
2 weeks. Yeah. But they got opened up pretty quick, smart, didn't they? You know, so obviously the fitness field doesn't stand in comparison to whatever the construction brings in, obviously. But, you know, like I think I don't believe physios were shut. I don't believe the other allied healths were shut. So if we were able to get ourselves somewhere where we could be, people don't like regulated, but more regulated so that we could fit in the allied health field, maybe gyms wouldn't have got shut. Maybe, you know, group training wouldn't have got shut. Outdoor training with more than one person wouldn't have got shut, you know, like, you know, so I think it's something that, again, it's something that's been going around our industry for a little while. It's something that Fitness Australia are looking at and sort of playing around with. But I think if there were, you know, I realistically think the best way to do it would be if there's a peak body, people will register with them. And the health, you know, your health people recognized, hey, if you're registered with these guys, we recognize you as a allied health professional or some kind of subset of that.
Yeah, my people speak to your people. So I think the easiest thing would be just to make it like an underling of the ex-phys world, because the ex-phys world's already recognized and a lot of PTs would be ex-phys. So you can just make them like a same way we've got clinical psychologists and then you've got like endorsed psychologists. You could be a subset of ex-physiologists. So you're an ex-physiologist or you're a PT who's registered and credited with XYZ. So, yeah, look, I think it'd be a great idea. And I'm sure if any of the public health officials, you know, were listening to this talk, they would 100% jump on board. But I'm not sure the podcast has quite got that political power just yet.
Well, one of the things, I don't know whether you mentioned it to me in a conversation or someone else did, but one of the people mentioned about you know, if the health insurances are usually pretty quick to adapt to things. Did you, I don't know, was it you
that mentioned this? Yeah, that was me.
So one of the things I believe you said, and you could probably, you know, elaborate on a little bit, is that, you know, if the health insurances are getting on board to say, hey, well, we're going to recognize PTs as like something that can register with us and we can claim, or they can claim, or people can claim their PT, it's a pretty good thing, because health insurance, they're not in the business of paying out money, you know, like, so do you want to elaborate a little bit on that statement?
Yeah, so essentially, one of the interesting things was looking over a bit of medical history, and before we knew that we should be treating high blood pressure, which I guess comes back to something I mentioned earlier, noting that for men, the risk, the percentage, you know, it was it's essentially 15% for men in terms of cause of mortality from hypertension, versus it's just below what the contribution of physical inactivity. So hypertension really bad for your longevity, significantly worse for men than women, surprisingly. So twice as risky for men as it was for women as a cause of death. But before GPs were treating high blood pressure or knowing that it was a problem, back in the good old days when they were still prescribing heroin to people with their anxiety issues and prescribing people cigarettes to deal with their anxiety issues as well. When, you know, we were taking blood pressures, and as long as you had a pulse, that was a good thing. So we know that low blood pressure is a terminal thing. So your blood pressure is really low, you're about to die, then we want to improve that. But the first people to take note of high blood pressure was actually the insurance companies. So when you did your insurance medical back in 1982 or 1882, they took your blood pressure, and if your blood pressure was above a certain cutoff, your premiums would be higher for your life insurance. So the insurance companies were the first ones to gather that, because they just do the numbers, they just deal with the evidence, they just deal with the facts, and they worked out pretty early that they have to pay out more to people who have high blood pressure because they're more likely to die. And so the insurance companies were on that before the medical field was onto it. I think by a decent decade or two, and then it sort of came back and said, "Oh well, I guess we better get on top of this and start treating these blood pressures." Another one that sort of circles back in terms of a bit of medical history, talking about the importance of exercise. There was a big case study in the UK in the bus industry, so they looked at the life expectancy of their employees on the bus system, on the big double-decker buses, and there was a significant difference between the bus drivers and the ticket operators. So similar pay, similar lifestyle, similar ages, you know, similar diets, but you had the one guy who was sitting there all day driving the bus, and you had the one guy who was walking up and down, walking up the stairs, and they lived 10 to 15 years longer.
Yeah, wow.
So that was one of the first things that found the real importance of physical activity was the difference of the sedentary lifestyle. So sitting there driving versus getting up and moving up the stairs and punching tickets and all that sort of stuff. So that's, you know, a little bit of medical history for you.
It's a good one. I like that one.
I throw that one in for free. I'll have to. So 80% of stats are made up on the spot. So the exact life difference, I'd have to look up the study, but it was not insignificant. And that's where they picked up the importance. And again, I think that might have been another insurance company thing where potentially they would have higher premiums if you're a bus driver versus if you're a ticket operator.
Yeah, wow. Obviously, people want to dive deeper into some of this info. We'll link all the notes and studies and stuff like that in the show notes, so you can check those out as well. But to round off today, what we want to sort of get out there to the masses a little bit of fitness professionals who are hopefully listening to this is the importance that we can play as a fitness professional in someone's longevity. And, you know, like making sure, A, you were saying in scope, but making sure we know that, hey, this person's got diabetes, this person's obese, this person's, what was the other one?
Obese, diabetic, and smoker.
Smoker. We can try and encourage them to change those things, obviously, but the biggest thing that we can have, the biggest impact we can have, is getting them moving. So Understanding that that is, in fact, a fact, and we can play a really important role in helping these people. And we don't need to go, you know, like people don't need to go, well, if you don't quit smoking, you know, doesn't matter anyway what you do, or all of these sort of things. We're able to stay in our lane and say, hey, let's focus on this thing first. And one of the things we always talk about is, I talk about like lining up people's dominoes. And the thought process is if you get people moving, or you can get people sleeping a little bit better, or like we usually use the walking as our first one. If you get people getting that 7,000 steps in a day, that's your first domino. And then the next domino might be drinking more water. And then the next domino might be sleeping better, you know, and then each one trickles to the other. And then maybe after they've achieved some of those things, they go, you know what? I don't feel like smoking as much, or I don't, you know, like, or my obesity is coming down, or my diabetics, you know, my diabetes is becoming better managed. So lining up those dominoes, and maybe the first domino should be physical activity. And from the sounds of it, that's the clear message here, is that the first domino in someone's health, when taking into those other factors, should be improving their physical activity.
Yeah, 100%. So I guess the big thing that I saw in a lot of the comment threads when you threw up these questions was, nah, fiction, got to get them to stop smoking, got to treat their diabetes, got to get them to lose weight. Like, and those things are true. But the fact of the matter is, the numbers are, if you've got a smoker and inactive, you get twice as much of a health benefit of getting them active. If you've got someone who's diabetic and inactive, it's four times the improvement of getting them active. If you've got someone who's obese and inactive, it is five times as effective to get them moving. So those are the facts. That's what it is. That's the difference. So the most important thing is to get them starting. And then you come back and think about other behaviors. Like, at the end of the day, like, I am very holistic in the way that I approach things. Why do people smoke? A lot of them do it for habitual, but a lot of them do it because they're anxious. Why do people become obese? A lot of time it's behavioral, but a lot of time they eat for comfort because of other anxiety issues, you know? So what can we do? We get them exercising. What is exercise? It's one of the most potent antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications we have. It is as effective, if not more effective, than low-dose antidepressants. So what we should be doing is getting them moving, because the thing is, getting them moving isn't only treating their physical inactivity and treating their low cardiovascular fitness. It will treat their obesity. It will treat their diabetes. It will make them less keen to smoke when they're coughing up a lung when they're trying to exercise. So the problem is, so it's not a us versus them, and that's why it's, you know, at the end of the day, everyone's correct when they're saying, no, we should be dealing with all these things. And yes, we should be dealing with all these things, but the most important thing is to get them moving, and there will be a trickle-down effect to those other problems. As you said, it is a domino. So once you knock down that big domino, which is getting them off their ass and getting them moving, they'll start feeling good about themselves. They'll start taking care of the other parts of their life. Maybe they'll start feeling able to go through the door to see a doctor, because the number of people I hear saying, fuck, I don't want to go back and see that GP because he just told me to lose weight. I don't want to go back and see that specialist because he just told me to lose weight. I don't want to go back and do this because they just told me to stop smoking and lose weight. Like, so people don't want to go see a doctor to have that. People don't want to hear it. They know this. They know they need to lose weight. They know that stuff. But if you can get them moving, maybe they lose a little bit of weight, and maybe they're not as apprehensive about going through the door to see the doctor, to manage their smoking and to manage their diabetes, because they're working on those things that they're embarrassed to get through that threshold because they don't want to feel judged. And I think the fitness industry is so amazing at making people feel comfortable of all sizes and shapes to get involved and get moving. You know, it's not a, I need to lose a little bit of weight before I can start working with the fitness industry. Like, you guys are so inclusive and open to all comers. And I think part of the issue is people don't want to come to GPs because GPs will just say, well, you should just lose some weight, just eat less, move more. Like, it doesn't encapsulate enough. And if only GPs were saying, look, you know, even if you're not losing the weight, getting moving will make a difference. It'll make you feel better. And, you know, as a side effect, you might lose some weight. Like, you know, it's a real holistic approach, but I'm just really passionate about exercise and getting people moving. I know it's a very potent thing for my own health and well-being and my own, like, you know, my own mental health, 100%. When I'm not exercising and not moving, it makes a massive difference. And if we did it on a social level, you know, game changer.
Love it. Love it. It's a great way to sign off today. For those listening in, if you want to take part in the conversation, in our Facebook community group, make sure hashtag the sporting doctor, ask any of your questions in there. We'll get to them over the coming, you know, episodes and weeks and whatever it might be. Throw them in there. We'd love to hear it. Whether there's things that you want debunked, whether there's things you want us to go in further, all that good stuff, throw it in our Facebook group and hashtag the sporting doctor. If you want to check out Craig on Instagram, it is at
the dot sporting doctor.
Beautiful. And then obviously if you are, you know, maybe want to check out and see him as a GP, if you're Sydney based, you might go to?
So check me out on my website. So it's highperformancemedical.com.au. At the moment, I run a clinic out in Picton, which is sort of just past southwest Sydney. But if you hang in there, it'll probably be expanding around the country with a main focus on just seeing sort of specialist sports medicine issues. Or if you're a pilot or a commercial diver, I can sort out your annual currency requirements on that field as well. Just to sum up, thank you so much for having me, Trav. Like, we've been talking about doing this for a while. I'd love to do this every couple of weeks, every month or so. You know, if you send me the questions in advance, I can do a little bit of research. But if you want to do a bit of a Q&A off the cuff, made up facts and figures, I could try that as well. But if you want some red hot hard data, you give me a little bit of prep time, and I can dig up some facts and sort out some facts and fictions for you.
Love it. All right, thanks for tuning in, everybody. This was Bro Science, part of the Fitness Education Online podcast, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening. If you liked this show, share it with your friends, subscribe on iTunes, and leave us a 5-star review. For show notes and free training on how to grow your fitness business, visit www.fitnesseducationonline.com.au.
Are you a fitness professional looking to provide your clients with personalized meal plans? Well, check out Mealsy, the ultimate solution for creating custom meal plans in just a few simple clicks. With Mealsy, you can say goodbye to countless hours spent on meal planning. Our Australian meal planning web app is designed to save you time and effort, so you can focus on what really matters, your clients and their success. Mealsy provides you with a vast library of recipes, all created by nutrition professionals, from breakfast to dinner and everything in between. We've got you covered. Whether you want to create a custom meal plan tailored to your client's needs or choose from our selection of ready-made meal plans, Mealsy has the flexibility to accommodate your preferences. So why waste precious time and energy creating meal plans from scratch? Let Mealsy do the heavy lifting for you, while you focus on delivering exceptional fitness services. Join the community of fitness professionals who have revolutionized their business with Mealsy. Visit our website at www.mealsy.com and sign up today. Mealsy, the smarter way to meal plan for fitness professionals.